He wanted to bring her to his favorite cafe in Honolulu Bay. He wanted to order her haupia.
"I've been trying to impress you,"
Jay admitted.
"Impress me?"
Lara said. There was delight in the wrinkle of her eyes, in the curved edges of her lips.
"Yeah,"
Jay said, nodding. His head was down, but his eyes were up and focused right on her.
"Ever since
that night," Lara said.
"Yeah, ever since that night, I haven't been able to stop thinking about you."
"You haven't?" Jay knew he was a fish on a hook, that she was reeling him in. He wanted to be reeled in. It felt good to be drawn in, to become intoxicated. It was the first time he'd ever desired someone so strongly, and he liked the feeling, the sweet ache of this specific wanting.
"I can't stop thinking about you," he said. I've gone into the sandcastle I don't even know how many times trying to run into you."
"I know," she said, smiling. He had been exposed, and it thrilled them both. He leaned toward her and put his lips to the spot on her cheekbone that bumped right up to her eye. It was hard like bone and smooth like velvet.
"Is it crazy to think I might love you?"
Jay whispered in her ear.
"It sounds a little crazy, yeah,"
Lara said, laughing.
"You don't know me all that well."
Jay was barely listening to her. He was lost in the commotion of his own heart.
"I don't know,"
he said, kissing her collarbone and running his hands up her legs.
"I think I know enough."
He kissed her on the mouth and held her in the front seat of his brother's truck. He thought of what they were about to do as more than just sex. It was a way for him to show her what he felt for her. It was a connection, a sacred act. He put his hands slowly up Lara's shirt, unbuttoned his pants, kicked off his shoes. Lara's skirt was pushed up to her hips, and Jay slipped his hands underneath. He gingerly and with great appreciation slipped her underwear off, leaving it hanging at her feet.
"Do you have a condom?"
Lara asked. He didn't, but he figured HUD might have some in the car. He turned to the dashboard and grabbed the keys from where the valet had left them. He took the smallest key and fit it in the glove box. With a turn, the box fell open with a thud, and there were condoms, three, all in a row in their shiny foil packets. Jay picked them up, ready to tear one off. But then, Jay grabbed the photo in the glove box that had now entered his field of vision, only to see that it was a full stack of photos. Photos of his ex-girlfriend blowing his brother. Photos that broke his already malfunctioning heart. HUD and Ashley had taken their shoes off, and neither one of them knew where they'd left them. They had walked so far down the beach that they did not exactly recognize where they were in the dark. HUD had already asked her a list of questions.
"How long have you known?"
"3 days."
"How far along?"
"7 weeks."
"Was it the weekend we went to La Jolla?"
"I think so."
"Are we ready to be parents?"
"I don't know how to know something like that." And now, as they walked hand in hand along the water, they were both quietly considering two futures, one with a baby and one without. HUD was thinking about renting a house. An Airstream was no place to raise a child. He was thinking about a 2-bedroom, and he imagined himself painting a nursery yellow. He thought of the sort of master bedroom his mother had. He had always liked that it had 2 sinks in the bathroom. He had always liked the idea of a mother and a father together at those sinks every night. HUD suddenly stopped, and Ashley stopped with him.
"What's the first thing you thought?"
he asked her.
"When you found out, when the test tube turned whatever color it turns."
"It's a ring that appears at the bottom."
"Well, then when the ring appeared, what was the first thought that popped into your head?"
"Well, what was the first thing in your head when I told you?"
Ashley said.
"Honestly?"
"Yes."
"I thought, how is it possible to love something that fast? Because I feel like the minute you said it, I felt it. And that doesn't make any sense at all."
Ashley's eyes started to water, and when she smiled, a tear fell.
You didn't think, oh shit, or fuck, or how do I get out of this?
Ashley asked, wiping her tears away.
No, Hud said, pulling her toward him. Did you?
No,
she said, shaking her head.
Not once.
So we're having a baby,
Hud said, holding her.
We're having a baby.
And they stood there, the cold water swirling up and chilling their ankles, smiling at each other. There would be rocking chairs and swaddles, mashed bananas and high chairs, the pride of a first step. There would be a wild and beautiful future. But for now, right now, Hud had no choice but to stop dancing around a lie. His families, old and brand new, were his to reconcile, his to fight and fight for. And he would do that now. He did not necessarily feel up to the task, but that hardly mattered.
Should we turn back? He asked.
Ashley looked up at him and gave him a gentle smile. She leaned into him farther, held his hand tighter.
All right,
she said. It was time to tell Jay the truth. 1 a.m. Brandon was in the guest bathroom of his own home, looking in the mirror. He was pretty buzzed already, heading straight to drunk, and he was staring at himself, wondering how he had made so many mistakes in such a small span of time. How could he have done all of this to Nina? She had weathered so many things so young, and he had always liked to think of himself as the beginning of good things for her. He liked to think that maybe, in some small way, he was her knight in shining armor. And then, like a moron, he'd started sleeping with Carrie Soto. There should be a way to undo your fuck-ups, not just redeem yourself for them, but actually undo them, make them so that they never happened. He wanted to take back every second of heartbreak he'd caused his wife. She did not deserve any of it, had done nothing to deserve his complete and disastrous breakdown. He wished the world would let them all just pretend the whole thing never happened. Brandon stared into the mirror and looked at his face, looked at the lines that had started to form. Every day of your life feels like you're climbing up the mountain, and then you get there and you stay for a bit. And it's nice at the top, but then you start sliding down the other side. He hadn't seen that part coming, and it had hit him hard. This had all started because 9 months ago, Brandon had been the number one seed in the Australian Open. Then he lost in the second round in an upset to a 17-year-old Scandinavian named Anders Larsson. From his first serve, Brandon had begun to worry that he was spinning out. He used his signature slingshot, something very few players could return. It cut fast and clean across the court. But Larsson returned it. It knocked Brandon off his feet, having to volley back and forth for the point. Point went to Larsson. So did the next one. The serve after that, he double-faulted. He found himself growing angry, looking at this teenager in front of him. The crowd started muttering, some of them cheering for Larsson. Larsson smiled at Brandon as he waited, crouched over and ready. It went through Brandon's mind that all the papers were anticipating Brandon and Creek in the finals, but now it was looking like he might not even make it past round two. He began overthinking. His shoulders started feeling tight. For a moment, it was as if his muscles did not remember. His serve got looser, slower. Every time he hit a forehand without spin, without precision, he grew more and more angry. Every backhand that missed his intended mark pushed him further into his own head and out of the game. Break point. When he missed the return on Larsson's last volley, he instantly felt the cameras on him. He'd felt this way before, trapped by the camera. The feeling had been manageable enough to shake off when the camera had caught him in victory, or even in a loss to a worthy opponent, but this had been a slaughter. He was Goliath, and he had just lost to David. Larson turned to the stands and shook his fists in the air, having beaten the current number one player in the world. The crowd cheered. Brandon, as he usually did in his rare moments like this, held his face tight, showing no sign of distress. He walked, his whole body tense, to the net. But this time, try as he might, he could not muster a smile as he shook that little fuck's hand. He knew his father would have been disappointed by his lack of sportsmanship, but that was the least of his problems. As he slinked into the locker room, his coach, Tommy, trailed behind him.
"What the fuck was that? I've never seen you so in your head. You don't have much time left on the court if that's all you have to bring."
Brandon was silent, his heart pounding. Tommy shook his head and left. And when he was gone, Brandon punched a hole in the wall of the men's locker room. Obviously, he'd lost before, but in the second round of a tournament he was supposed to win? Brandon had gone home to Nina, but the second he opened the front door and saw her, he could not stand the look on her face. Her eyes were wide and welcoming. Her mouth was turned down softly in a kind frown. "How are you doing?" she had asked him. He'd wanted to jump out of his skin. Nina had put her arms around him and hugged him, and then she'd put her hand to his face. "You are a great man," she'd said. "You've already proven that. I mean, you have 10 grand slams. That's unbelievable." Brandon had taken her hand and moved it away from his face. "Thank you," he'd said, as he got up and went to take a shower. He could not bear to look at her. Next up, in January, he was out in the third round at the US Pro Indoor. Fucking McEnroe. Then he lost in straight sets at the Davis Cup in March. The US team didn't even make it to the quarterfinals. At the Donne Open, he lost in the semifinals and chucked his racket on the ground. It made headlines. He pulled out of Monte Carlo on account of his shoulder. Brandon stopped coming home directly after his matches. He told Nina he had to visit his mother or his brother in New York. He made plans for himself and Tommy to stay longer in Buenos Aires and Nice. When he did finally come home, he would talk to Nina about dinner and the restaurant and her siblings and his travel plans and her schedule and what art to buy for the downstairs den. He would not talk to her about tennis. He would not tell her his shoulder was killing him. He would sneak out to doctor's appointments, never told her he'd begun getting cortisone shots. He was supposed to be indestructible. He was supposed to be humble, despite being brilliant, affable, despite his sheer domination on the court. He was not supposed to be out in the early rounds and pitied by his wife. Enter Carrie Soto. Carrie Soto was considered the greatest female tennis player of all time. Brandon had met Carrie before, but they had never had a conversation until one day back in May in Paris. He was at the French Open without Nina because he'd insisted she stay home. He was sitting on a bench outside the locker room at Roland Garros just before his first match, adjusting the sweatband on his head. Carrie Soto walked by him with her tense body and perfect posture in her tennis whites. Her dark hair was pulled back under her visor. Her rosy skin, wide eyes, and button nose made her seem cute. But then when she got an earshot of Brandon, she leaned over and said to him, "Your nice guy routine doesn't fool me. You're as bloodthirsty as the rest of us. Get your serve in line and murder them all." Brandon turned and looked at her, his eyes wide. She smiled at him, and he smiled back. Brandon won his first match, then another, and by the skin of his teeth, over the course of 2 weeks, he earned the Coupe de Mousquetaire. When he won the last match of the finals, he pumped his fist into the air. Meanwhile, Carrie Soto crushed every single opponent she had with force and determination. She grunted with every serve, yelped as she volleyed, dove with abandon, smearing her tennis whites with the red clay of the court. And she won the Coupe de Suzanne Lenglen. The night after he won, Brandon ran into Carrie at their hotel, the two of them raging champions pacing in an elevator. Brandon felt victorious and vulnerable, gleeful and unguarded. "I told you you could be vicious," Carrie said, grinning.
"I guess you've got my number," Brandon said.
There was a pause as the elevator rose. When it stopped at Brandon's floor, he said,
"Let me know if you want to split something from the minibar."
10 minutes later, they were in his room. Carrie Soto was on top of him, and he could feel her muscles in his hands. He could feel, as she moved, how hard her thighs were, how tight her butt was, how swollen her calves and forearms were. He could feel, as he touched her, her strength and agility. He was holding her power in his hands. And for one small moment, while he was lying underneath her, he thought he'd found the other half of himself. When he woke up the next morning, his head throbbed with the realization of what he had done. But just before Carrie left Paris, she told him she thought, just maybe, this could be something serious. And that made him wonder if all of this wasn't just cheating, but perhaps something else, like a love affair. He'd never thought it before, but maybe Nina was wrong for him. Maybe that was why she made him feel so small. And maybe Carrie was right for him. That was why she made him feel so strong. So he kept seeing her, in LA, in New York, in London. And soon, Brandon had convinced himself that Carrie was his good luck charm. After they both won at Wimbledon, Brandon was flying high. He'd won clay and grass courts in the same year, nearly unheard of. "This," Tommy said, "is the Brandon I know." The tabloids caught Carrie and him celebrating their wins together that night outside the Wimbledon ball. He was in a tux. Carrie was in a navy blue gown. They were kissing beside a car. His hand was on her ass. Carrie saw the photos first and bought off the photographer and the magazine. She traded the photos for an exclusive with her. But afterward, she told Brandon that she was in love with him and it was time to shit or get off the pot. Brandon felt rushed. He wasn't sure he was ready to commit to leaving Nina, but he was at a crossroads in more ways than one, and he suspected that if he stayed with Nina, happiness and satisfaction might just soften him too much, enough that he might not fight hard enough against the descent of his talent. If he stayed with Carrie, the best of his times on the court might be yet to come. So Brandon flew home. He walked into his massive house and headed right up the stairs to get his things. He was hoping Nina wasn't home, but he found her in the bedroom, reading a travel guide to Bora Bora. She was wearing his boxer shorts. He could barely look at her. "Hi, honey," she said sweetly. He went straight to the closet. He had to move fast. He had to get this over with quickly for the both of them. And he did not think he could bear to look at her. He was not sure he'd keep his nerve.
"I'm sorry, Nina," he said, "but I'm leaving."
"What are you talking about?" she said, the bubbliness still in her voice. He did not remember what she said after that. He had simply run away. He went right to the Beverly Hills Hotel. And when he got to Carrie's suite, he kissed her at the front door and said,
"I love you. I choose you."
The whole thing with Nina had been hideous and unbearable, but it had been necessary. And it was done. Brandon stayed with Carrie and found that an entire new life had been mapped out for him within days. In the mornings, they would both have protein smoothies and a handful of raw almonds and then go to the gym together. They started training at the same courts side by side at the Bel Air Country Club. Brandon's cortisone shot was wearing off sooner than he'd anticipated, but if at any time Brandon started to slow down his serves or miss a few volleys in a row, Carrie would notice and yell to him from her court without missing a beat of her own. "Get it together, Randall! You're either a champion or a fuck-up. There is no in-between." And he would run faster, hit more cleanly. In the afternoon, they dealt with business, calling their agents, discussing endorsement deals, approving travel, sending correspondence. By 7 every evening, they were out the door, ready to go to dinner. The two of them were usually at a party, charity function, or gala by 9. They talked almost exclusively about how much Carrie hated her rival, Paulina Stepanova. One night, in the middle of the night, Brandon woke up with his shoulder throbbing. They'd had an intense practice in the morning and a gala for Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in the evening, and then they'd come home and made love before turning out the lights. Suddenly, at 3 in the morning, the pain was excruciating. He called down for ice, but it did not do much to help. He popped a few meds, but the pain was getting sharper, throbbing harder. He woke Carrie up in a panic.
"What if Wimbledon was my last slam?" he asked her.
"That would be catastrophic," Carrie said. "You only have 12. And then she turned her body away from his and went to bed. He ached for the tenderness of Nina. He fell asleep just in time to wake up to Carrie throwing a towel at him.
"Do we cry about the pain, or do we man up and play through it? Car leaves for the court in 15.
He got up, got dressed, and kept her pace all day. And then the next, and the next, and on it went. Brandon had lived his life beside Carrie for another 4 weeks and 2 days. But then, again last night, the ache in his shoulder had woken him up. This time it was a searing, burning pain. Every second before the meds kicked in was agonizing. He had made an appointment for another shot, and he knew that would help for a little while. But he understood, in some disturbingly clear way, that the clock was ticking. Even if he staved off the decline as long as possible, even if he won more championships than any other human in history, someday his body was going to break down, because everyone's did. And who would love him then? It took him 2.5 hours to fall asleep. And then that morning, he had been woken up at 6 o'clock to hear Carrie talking to room service, saying,
"Don't send salted nuts. I don't want salt in the morning. You sent salted nuts yesterday after I asked you 3 times not to. If you can't send the right type of nuts, maybe you should be in another field of work."
Then she hung up the phone. Brandon had laid his head back on his pillow. She was not a kind person. He wasn't even sure she was a good person. Before he knew what he was doing, he opened his mouth.
"Oh my God," he said. "You're awful. What the fuck have I done?"
He got out of bed and started gesticulating wildly, going on about what an uptight ice woman she was.
"I've made every wrong turn a person could make," he said, standing in his boxers. "I don't think I love you. I'm not sure I have ever loved you. Why would I think this was where I wanted to be? I don't want to be with a woman who screams at people."
Carrie stared at him like he had 2 heads, and then she said,
"No one is making you stay here, you gigantic fucking prick."
Brandon considered her words and realized she was right. No one had made him sleep with her. No one had made him leave his wife for her. He'd done it all himself. But he simply could not, for the life of him, remember why any of that had felt like such a good idea.
"I think I should go," he said.
"Be my guest," Carrie said, gesturing to the door. "And feel free to fuck right off."
Brandon grabbed his things and left. He trained that morning at a different court. He took a long, punishingly hot shower. Then he sat in the locker room in his towel for an hour, immobile, considering what to do. All he could think of was how good it felt when Nina rubbed her hands through his hair, or the look on her face when she told him she'd love him forever. Right then and there, he had made up his mind to get her back. And he had. And now everything would be okay. As long as Carrie Soto left them alone. Nina and Casey were sitting in silence when someone opened the door.
"Nina?"
They both turned to see Taryn.
"You need to come downstairs," she said.
Why?
It is Carrie Soto. Nina was already tired.
What about her?
She is on your front lawn, throwing clothes and threatening to light them on fire.
Nina started down the stairs, making her way through the crowd with Tureen. Greg Robinson had the music up so loud it was shaking the ground, vibrating the very foundation of the house. People were dancing with such fervor in the living room that the picture frames were bouncing against the walls. It was Nina's house, Nina's carpet they were standing on, her stairs supporting them, her booze they were drinking, her food they were eating. And yet, each person in Nina's way remained in her way until she tapped them on the shoulder or nudged herself through. She found herself growing more and more annoyed. Her husband's mistress was on the front lawn, and she couldn't even get outside to deal with it because there was a group of pro surfers smoking pot in her foyer.
"Excuse me," Tureen said. "Get out of the way."
The surfers moved immediately. When Nina finally made her way to the front of the house, she looked out to the driveway to see her husband trying to calm a woman who was waving her arms around and ranting. Carrie Soto, in white track pants and a white and green t-shirt, was standing on the gravel in her driveway with Brandon's clothes dumped in a pile. Nina could see Brandon's favorite black Ralph Lauren polo off to the side, saw his lucky white sweatband lying on the rocks. He loved that sweatband. He came back to me, but left his sweatband with her?
Brandon, I swear to God, you need to stop being such an asshole. I really might just burn all of your shit to the ground, Carrie said.
The crowd outside was entirely focused on Carrie, giving her a wide berth. People were coming around from the sides of the house to see what the commotion was. Nina could feel the people behind her peering over her head to see more.
Carrie, please, Brandon was saying.
He was standing just at the foot of the steps, his arms up in defense.
Let's talk about this like adults.
Carrie started laughing, not maniacally, not angrily, but rather with genuine amusement.
I am the adult, Brandon. I am the one who told you not to leave your wife unless you were serious about us. Do you remember that?
Brandon started to say more, but Carrie interrupted.
Do you remember me telling you that I would not allow myself to be a homewrecker unless you and I were truly in love? That this was forever? Do you remember me telling you that?
Brandon nodded.
Yes, but Carrie...
No, don't yes but me. You're an asshole, Brandon. Do you get that?
Carrie...
What did I tell you when we first slept together, Brandon? What did I say? Did I say to you that I wasn't going to sleep with another woman's husband unless it was for something real?
Yes, but...
And did I tell you that you better not fuck with my heart? Did I tell you that, Brandon?
Carrie...
I believe my exact words, you son of a bitch, were if I fall in love with you, don't fuck me over.
I don't know if...
No, don't argue with me. That is what I said.
Okay, that is what you said, but...
You woke up this morning after making love to me the night before, and when I got off the phone with room service to order us raw almonds, you said, and I quote, "Oh my God, you're awful. What the fuck have I done?" And then you left.
Carrie, please, can we talk about this in private?
Carrie looked around, taking in the crowd that was forming. Then she looked behind Brandon to the front door where she saw Nina. Her face fell. Brandon turned and saw Nina too.
Nina, he said.
Nina, Carrie interrupted. I am sorry. I shouldn't have taken up with him, and I shouldn't be airing all of this dirty laundry and ruining your party.
Nina continued staring at Carrie, but didn't say anything. How was it that this woman could shout out every thought running through her head? Why was it that Carrie Soto felt entitled to scream? In that moment, Nina was not mad or jealous or embarrassed or anything else she might have expected. Nina was sad. Sad that she'd never lived a fraction of a second like Carrie Soto. What a world she must live in, Nina thought, where you can piss and moan and stomp your feet and cry in public and yell at the people who hurt you, that you can dictate what you will and will not accept. Nina, Her entire life had been programmed to accept. Accept that your father left. Accept that your mother is gone. Accept that you must take care of your siblings. Accept that the world wants to lust after you. Accept, accept, accept. For so long, Nina had believed it was her greatest strength, that she could withstand, that she could endure, that she would accept it all and keep going. It was so foreign to her, the idea of declaring that something was unacceptable. Nina thought of herself driving to someone else's house to scream on their front lawn while a whole party's worth of people watched. It was so impossible that she couldn't even summon a mental picture. But Carrie had this fire within her. Where was Nina's fire? Had it ever been there? And if so, when did it go out? Her husband had slept with Carrie last night, and then Nina had taken him back this evening. What was wrong with her? Was she just going to accept it all? Just accept every piece of bullshit thrown at her for the rest of her life? When Nina opened her mouth to speak, her voice was flat and calm and controlled. "I think you two need to leave," she said. Brandon wasn't sure he'd heard her right. Carrie didn't hear her at all. "I think you two need to leave," Nina said again, this time louder.
"Honey, no," Brandon said, trying to move toward her.
Nina put up her hand.
"No."
"Nope," she said calmly.
"Leave me out of this. You two can have each other."
"I don't want him," Carrie said. "I just wanted him to know that you can't treat people like dirt and think they are just going to take it."
Nina hated how small she felt in that moment for having taken him back.
"How dare you come to this house?"
Taryn said to Carrie. Her voice was loud and angry, and when Nina looked at her, she could tell that Taryn had been seething for quite some time.
"For what it's worth, I hate myself," Carrie said to Nina and Taryn. "And I know I shouldn't be here. I'm just really sick and tired of people thinking they can treat me like I don't have a heart, like mine doesn't break too."
Nina looked at her and nodded. She understood Carrie Soto, understood she was heartbroken, understood that in another world they might even be friends, but they were in this world, and they were not friends.
"You have no right going around acting like you're Mr. Nice Guy. You're an asshole," Carrie said to Brandon. "All I wanted to do was give you back your stuff and tell you that. But then you pissed me off trying to shoo me away like some shameful secret. Like you didn't come on to me. Like you didn't start this whole thing."
Carrie turned around and walked back to her Bentley, which she'd left running, the driver's door still open.
"I'm sorry, everyone," she said. "I really am."
She backed her car up, bumped against a palm tree, put it in drive, and took off. Brandon watched her drive out of sight, and then, wearing a look of shock and embarrassment, moved toward his wife. Nina put up her hands again, in front of everyone.
"You need to go too." "Nina, honey, it's over with Carrie."
"I don't care. Please, Brandon, just go."
Nina was relieved to hear herself say it, relieved she was capable of this.
"You can't kick me out," Brandon said. "It's my house. This is my house."
"So then take the house," Nina said. "It's yours."
And the moment she relinquished that stupid cliffside monstrosity and the tennis star that came with it, Nina Riva felt 100 times lighter. There was finally enough air within her for a fire to ignite. Casey Greens looked at herself in the mirror of Nina's master bathroom, splashing her face with cold water and then drying it with a lush taupe towel. Everything in this house was so nice. The towels were so soft. The rooms were so big. She looked at the floor-to-ceiling windows and the mirrored walls and the 1,000 thread-count pillowcases. But Casey ached for her old world, where the pillows were a little scratchy and the windows were small and always sort of stuck with humidity and old paint, where dinner was always a little overcooked, where her mom got every question wrong on Jeopardy every night, but they all sat on the couch together and had fun listening to her guess hopelessly anyway. If Casey could, if the devil ever bartered, she would have sold her soul to leave this place and have her parents back. She felt a wave of despair coming toward her, ready to take her under. This had been happening on and off since she lost them. Casey had learned that the best thing to do was to brace herself for every rush of grief. She would let the sadness and sorrow wash over her, smother her. She held on tight, knowing all she could do was feel the pain until it passed. She opened her eyes and looked at herself in the mirror once more. Maybe she didn't belong here. Maybe she didn't belong anywhere, wouldn't belong anywhere. Ever again. Nina walked back into the house, trying to pretend she had not just suffered the indignity of her husband's mistress on her front lawn. And then she went right through the kitchen, opened up the pantry door, and walked in. There, among the bags of rice and the cans of tomato sauce, Nina closed her eyes and settled herself. While the pantry door hummed with the sounds of the Eurythmics and the noise of people talking and laughing still penetrated the space, it was quiet enough to find stillness. Nina rested her famous ass on a stack of paper towel rolls and pulled her shoulder blades in toward each other, fixing her posture, releasing some of the tension from her back. For fuck's sake. Her husband had returned, his mistress had shown up, she might have a long-lost sister, and her brother was sleeping with her other brother's ex-girlfriend. She just wanted the night to be over. The pantry door opened, showering Nina with light and sound. She looked up to see Taryn standing in front of her with a bottle of wine and two glasses. "Hi, doll," Taryn said as she slipped in and shut the door behind her. She pulled on the cord hanging above their heads. The light went on. "Brandon is upstairs packing up your things," Taryn said. "He is drunk, obviously, and he thinks he is kicking you out of the house." Nina laughed. She had no choice but to find it funny. Taryn sat down next to Nina and grabbed a corkscrew from her jacket pocket. She started opening up the bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. Once the cork was popped, she poured some wine into a glass and handed it to Nina, then poured one for herself.
"Someone took the rest of the Opus One," Taryn said. "These people are animals. I got us a white this time."
Nina took it, but didn't drink out of it yet.
"Drink up," Taryn said as she took a sip of her own. "We are celebrating your Declaration of Independence."
Nina looked at Taryn, and a small smile crept out of the corner of her mouth. She took a sip, and then she drank some more. Good God, she could drink the whole bottle right now.
"I didn't expect him to come back," Nina said. "I know. Once he left, I don't know, our relationship felt over for me. I was mourning it."
"Rightfully so."
"And I've been really sad," Nina added, that I meant so little to someone who had made me believe I meant so much."
Taryn grabbed Nina's hand and squeezed it.
"But there was no part of me that wanted him back,"
Nina said, finally looking Taryn in the eye. Taryn smiled.
"Good,"
she said with a firm nod. Nina lifted her wine glass to her lips again. She could smell the sweet astringency of the contents of the glass, and she felt like she could get lost in it. And then she had this image, suddenly, of her mother on the couch in front of the television. Her blood ran cold. Nina put the glass down.
"When he showed up here tonight, do you know what I thought?" she said.
"What?"
"I went, oh fuck, now we have to do this whole song and dance?"
Taryn smiled.
"But you do not."
"No," Nina said. "I don't, do I?"
She didn't have to do any of this. The victimization, the acceptance of bullshit, the leaving your heart in the hands of an asshole yet again. She could just decide not to. Nina smiled. She had to sit with that one for a moment. It was almost too good to be true. Jay dropped the photos back into the glove box and tried to pretend that he hadn't seen them, that it hadn't happened, that it wasn't true, that his brother wouldn't do that. He must be misunderstanding the photos. He must be, because he could not possibly believe that his brother was not only that much of an asshole, but also that much of a liar. He tried to put the thoughts out of his head by moving on top of Lara, by refocusing his attention on her. But as he put his hand up her skirt, as he unzipped his own pants, the thought just kept reverberating in his head that he couldn't possibly deny what he'd seen with his own two eyes. Lara moved from under Jay and pushed him down onto the bench seat. He let her do whatever it was she wanted to do, lost in his own thoughts, hoping desperately she could take him somewhere else. Lara climbed on top of him and began to move, her shirt lifted to expose her breasts, her skirt around her hips. The top of her head kept hitting the ceiling of the truck, and Jay, trying so very hard to focus on Lara, couldn't help but wonder if HUD had fucked Ashley in this truck, just like this, if Ashley's head had also hit the ceiling. When they were both done, Lara leaned off him, pulled down her shirt and her skirt, and said, "You're nearly catatonic. What's the matter?" Jay looked at her as he sat up. "I think my brother's sleeping with my ex-girlfriend," he said, "and lying about it. Earlier tonight, he sold me some bullshit about wanting to ask her out, and I said no, and now I find out he's probably been fucking her this whole time." Lara sat up straighter, surprised. "I'm sorry," she said, putting her hand on his back. Jay's anger raged inside his chest, but Lara's soothing hand helped calm him. "If I had to find out about this shit, I'm glad it's with you," he said. Lara smiled, but Jay noticed that it didn't look very sincere. It was like the smile you give to the guy who bags your groceries. "I meant what I said earlier," he said, "about thinking I might love you." "Jay," she said, "I guess I'm saying that I do. I love you. I love you." Jay was expecting Lara to smile, or get a little weepy, or blush. Women had pressured him to say it before, and he never had. But now here he was, saying it, and he was excited for whatever would come next, however happy it would make her. But instead, he watched as her eyes went blank and her smile stiffened. I don't know that we feel the same way about each other," she said. Jay shook his head, confused. "Wait, what? I'm sorry." Jay's face hardened slowly but steadily from a warm, languid pool to a glacier. "Wow," he said, stunned. "Jay, I really am sorry. I think I misunderstood what you were looking for." "I wasn't looking for anything," he said, moving away from her, putting his shoes back on. "But clearly, you're not the person I thought you were, so whatever." "Jay, that's not—" "No, I should have known," he said as he opened the driver's side door and hopped out of the truck. He stood with both feet on the ground, looking at Lara, who had not moved from her seat. "That's why I didn't tell anybody about us, because I knew you were this kind of girl. I knew you weren't the kind of girl you marry." Jay could think of no bigger insult, so he felt he'd reclaimed some sense of power after lobbing it at her. But she seemed unfazed. "All right," Lara said, putting her hand on the door handle. "Get out of my brother's car," Jay said, his voice rising. "Please be careful," Lara said as she got up. "I'm worried about your heart." Jay narrowed his eyes and slammed the door shut. "I guess I should go," Lara said. They stood on either side of the truck, looking at each other. "I honestly don't care what you do," Jay said, before walking away, swiftly at first, eager for distance. He slowed down when he got closer to the front door of the house. There were clothes all over the yard, and people milling around, holding their drinks, smoking their cigarettes, all consumed with talking about something. But Jay wasn't listening. Just as he got to the front door, he turned around to see if Lara was still there. He saw her getting her car from the valet. She took her keys, got in the front seat, and began to drive off. When she turned onto the road and out of sight, Jay thought he'd feel better, but he didn't. Of course he didn't. Mick took a right onto PCH off Chautauqua, but he did not bother to use his blinker. Speeding up the highway, ocean to his left, mountains to his right, he turned his attention briefly to the invitation. He found himself growing a tiny bit nervous, his heart beating in irregular rhythm. He was preparing his apologies in his head, framing and reframing his past actions to create a story his kids would understand, one they could forgive. Now was the time for them all to run down to the ocean and baptize themselves in the sea and start again. He was doing this for himself, yes, but he was doing this for them too. What broken family, no matter how shattered or tattered or bruised beyond recognition, does not ache to be reunited? What child, no matter how lost or abandoned, does not ache to be loved? Mick pulled up to the red stoplight at Heathercliff Road, and when it turned green, he turned left without his blinker. Kit was standing in the outdoor bathroom staring at the stars. Ricky was sucking on her neck so hard she was pretty sure she was going to end up with a hickey. She couldn't look at him. She couldn't bear to, so she kept looking up at the night sky, trying to find the Big Dipper. Ricky could not believe his good fortune. He was here, making out with Kit Reva in an outdoor shower. Kit Reva! In an outdoor shower. He wanted to take her out on romantic dates to Italian restaurants and buy her flowers and go surfing with her and just generally be in her presence all the time. Ricky was so flabbergasted and ahead of himself, so enchanted and eager, that it was almost as if his excitement could sustain them both. Almost. Ricky was no Don Juan, but he'd been with women before. He'd had a high school dalliance, a college girlfriend. He knew how it felt when a girl was as excited to be with you as you were to be with her. And Ricky was starting to worry, because of the way Kit wasn't looking him in the eye, the way she kept freezing up when he touched her, the way she moved her pelvis farther from him, that she didn't really want to be here. Ricky stood back for a moment and tried to get Kit to look at him, but she averted her gaze.
Kit,
Ricky said.
What?
She asked.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Why wouldn't I want to do this?
Kit said.
I don't know.
Ricky shrugged.
I was just getting the impression maybe you weren't into it.
Well, I am,
Kit said.
Okay,
Ricky said.
If you're sure.
I'm sure,
she said, and she pulled him to her and kissed him again. Kit was hiding, and she knew it. She understood very clearly that once she admitted to herself she didn't like kissing Ricky, she would have to admit she didn't want to kiss men at all, that she didn't like their roughness, their smell, the coarseness of their faces, that she'd never once looked at a man and desired him. She knew that as soon as she pulled away from Ricky Esposito, she was going to have to accept that she had always, her entire life, desired softness, curves and smooth skin and long hair and soft lips. She had always ached to be touched with gentle hands. Kissing Ricky felt all wrong because he wasn't Juliana Thompson. He wasn't Cheryl Nilsson or Violet North. He wasn't even Wendy Palmer, the waitress at the restaurant with whom Kit always felt a thrill when they shared a shift. She wished, for just one moment, he was that cocktail waitress she'd met earlier tonight, the one with the red hair, Caroline. But Kit kept kissing Ricky, hoping some internal desire would kick in, even though she knew that she had all the answers she'd been looking for. Kit knew now, in her heart, in her body, that she liked girls the way other girls liked boys. All she had done this evening by finally kissing a boy was show herself just how much she'd never cared about kissing a boy at all. She pulled away from Ricky.
You're right, I can't do this.
Okay, Ricky said, backing off.
Sorry if I pushed you or anything.
No, Kit said. It's fine. She wasn't sure how to finish her sentence, and so, instead, she sat down on the bench in the shower. Ricky sat down next to her.
I'm sorry, she said. I don't think I'm this kind of person.
What kind of person? Kit wasn't sure how to say it, or even what she wanted to say.
The sort of person that wants to make out with a dude in an outdoor shower right now.
Ricky nodded, forlorn, but keeping a smile on his face as best he could.
Okay, he said. I got it.
It's not you, Kit said. Ricky looked at her. She was finally looking him in the eye.
But I should take the hint that this is probably it for us, huh?
Kit smiled at him, kindly.
I think maybe we should think of ourselves as friends.
Ricky nodded and stared at his own feet.
But like, real friends, Kit added, trying to get his attention back. Like, I sincerely mean that. If I was going to like a guy, I think it would be you.
Ricky cocked his head to the side, not quite sure what she was trying to tell him.
Ricky, Kit said, unsure if she could even complete the sentence she was starting. But didn't she have to start somewhere?
And wasn't this the safest place to start, with someone she could avoid for the rest of her life if need be?
It really isn't you. It's...
Ricky caught her eyeline.
It's what?
You can tell me, honestly. I'm a really good listener. Kit closed her eyes and let it fly.
What if I told you I like girls?
She opened her eyes, unsure what she might see on Ricky's face. Ricky was quiet for a moment. All Kit could discern was surprise.
That makes sense. Girls are hot, he said, nodding.
And then he laughed. And Kit laughed too. She threw her head back and cackled, her shoulders moving up and down as the laugh ran through her. Ricky looked up at her and felt even more drawn in. The way her eyes looked so warm and bright, the way her smile created little dimples on her cheeks. He had been so close to the girl he'd always wanted, and now he understood it truly was never going to happen. But that's how life goes, Ricky thought. You don't always get the things you want.
Thank you, Kit said. Thank you for that.
Hey, that's what friends are for, right? He told her.
I guess so, Kit said.
Yeah. So, look, here's the real question. If we are actually friends, as you say, does that mean you might teach me to surf? He asked her. Kit laughed.
You don't know how?
She really did like him. He was easy to be around.
I'm not very good, Ricky said.
Certainly not as good as you.
Nobody's as good as me, Kit said.
And Ricky laughed.
I know, so you gotta teach me.
Kit smiled at him and hoped that one day she might meet a girl like Ricky. Someone kind, someone who didn't have anything to prove. She had so much to prove. There wasn't any room for anyone else to prove much.
All right, Kit said. I'll teach you.
And then she leaned over and she kissed Ricky on the cheekbone. It was the first time Kit had kissed someone with all of her heart. Taryn had been wrong. Brandon wasn't packing Nina's things. He had taken a bottle of Seagram's upstairs and sat down in the first open bedroom, one of the guest rooms, and now he was wallowing on the floor. This was the room he'd imagined would belong to his first child. Now he was sitting in it, crying by himself, back against the nightstand, drinking whiskey out of the bottle. What the fuck is the matter with you, Brandon? Either one of those women would have made you happy, would have given you more than you ever deserved. How did you fuck that up? God, this was bad. He really didn't want to be left alone at the end of all this. He drank more of his whiskey and gagged at the sheer amount that was flowing down his throat. He wiped his mouth. He had to fix this. He had to get one of them back. He had to. And he could. He knew he could. All he had to do was convince one of them that he wasn't a shit, which was easy enough because he really had not been that much of a shit until recently. Even the tabloids would tell you he really was a good guy. He just needed to listen to his gut and choose the love of his life. And then he would get her back and be a good husband and have children and win more titles and have his life look just like it looked on the pages of the magazines, just like it was supposed to. Brandon Randall was about to pass out, but once he woke up, world, watch out. He was going to go get one of those women back if it was the last thing he did. Jay was searching for HUD everywhere. He scanned the crowds in every room, pushing through people giving him dirty looks at being moved aside, smelling cigarette smoke and skunk weed, body odor and perfume. HUD was not in the front yard, downstairs, or upstairs. He was not in the backyard as far as Jay could see through the windows. Jay made it back to the bottom of the landing. He turned to a brunette woman in a polka dot dress smoking a joint. "Have you seen HUD?" Jay said. "Who's HUD?" the woman asked, completely uninterested. Jay looked at her sideways. "Who the fuck are you?" he asked her. "Heather," she said, smiling. "Well, Heather, HUD is my brother, and he's fucking my girlfriend, and I need to find him." Heather put out her hand, offering Jay the butt of her joint. "You need this more than I do."
"No, thank you."
"Are you sure?" Jay frowned and took the joint from her. He put it to his lips and pulled in the smoke. He closed his eyes, let it permeate his lungs, sink into his body. He opened his eyes back up.
"Do you feel better now?" Heather asked him.
Jay thought about it.
"No, not at all."
"Okay," Heather said, shrugging. "Well, that's all I got."
She turned away from him and resumed her conversation with the Laker girl she'd been talking to.
"Okay, but like, Larry Bird is good, though."
Jay closed his eyes and pinched his nose, wondering why the fuck anyone would be defending the Celtics, but he didn't have time to fight her on it. He made his way to the backyard again, still trying to find HUD. He was still seething inside, but his rage had nowhere to go. He tried to relax, tried to calm himself down. He didn't see HUD anywhere. Now Vanessa was sitting in the lap of Kyle Manheim, making out with him. Jesus, Vanessa. Jay made a note to himself to tell her she could do better than Kyle, but for now, he simply tapped her on the shoulder. Vanessa turned and looked at him.
"Hey,"
she said. She seemed tipsy, but far from blotto.
"Have you seen HUD?"
Jay asked her. Vanessa shook her head.
"No. And you know what? I don't care that I haven't seen him. How's that? For once in my life, I can honestly say I just don't care."
Jay had already stopped listening. His eye caught sight of the cliff's edge and the stairs to the beach.
"Yeah, cool."
He walked, slowly and deliberately, making eye contact with no one until he got to the edge of the lawn. He looked down at the water, at the sand. On the beach, he saw two people in an embrace, and he could instantly recognize the asshole he was looking for. HUD. Jay's rage turned red hot once again as he realized Ashley was there with him. This was fucking rich. Jay watched them start to make their way up the stairs to the backyard. He paced around, talking himself up and down, unsure of what he would do when they reached the top. Mick pulled his car into the driveway of his daughter's house. He handed his keys over without even looking at the valet's face. He stood in the driveway, gazing up at the full scope of Nina's home, and fixed the knot of his tie. Mick was surprised by the sheer size of the house. Nina's husband must have bought it. Brandon something, the tennis player. He felt his hackles go up.
Are you...
Eliza Nakamura said to Mick as he walked past her toward the front door. Mick looked at her. She was good looking. If it had been the right time, he might have given her his signature smolder, lifted the edges of his famous lips to give her a grin. But Mick had learned nearly 25 years ago that his gravitational pull was such that he had to repel anyone he did not wish to actively attract.
"Not now," he said to the young woman.
Eliza turned away from him, annoyed, and moved on. She would tell people for the rest of her life that she'd met Mick Riva once and he was a dickhead. Mick did not care if people thought he was an asshole, as long as they left him alone when he did not want them and flocked to him when he did. He ignored each and every person in the front yard who stared at him as he walked by them and headed straight over the threshold of his daughter's mansion. There was an audible gasp from one of the cocktail waitresses when she saw him. That made the two bartenders over by the record players look up toward the door, and they both did double takes. Seeing the bartenders out of the corner of his eye, Greg Robinson, still ripping it up, moved his eye to the door and saw a legend he once knew years before standing there. His hand slipped, and the record scratched. Then everyone in the living room looked up at the door, a house full of stars, all staring at the biggest star in the room. The gasps and whispers started, and within approximately 45 seconds of Mick placing his foot in the house, the entire party knew he was there. The entire party, except for Casey Greens, who was hiding upstairs in the master bedroom, and Kit, who was with Ricky Esposito in her sister's outdoor shower, and Jay, who was outside looking for Hud, and Hud, who was down at the beach, and Nina, who had locked herself in the pantry. Hud spotted Jay out of the corner of his eye as he was making his way up the stairs with Ashley. The moment he saw him, his heart dropped. It was clear that Jay already knew what he'd resolved to tell him. Jay had the gait and the fury of a man recently made aware. Hud turned back to Ashley briefly as they came up the path. He looked at her with warning and apology, and in his glance, she knew what he was trying to tell her. This is going to get worse before it gets better. Hud put his feet on the grass at the edge of the lawn, and Ashley followed him and then stepped aside, out of the line of fire. Jay was in Hud's face in no time.
"You are a real piece of shit," Jay said. "You know that?"
"I know," Hud said. He did not ask how much Jay knew or how Jay knew. He understood those questions would only serve to make things worse. Jay shook his head, trying to speak, but finding himself dumbfounded. What on earth could he possibly say that would come close to conveying his rage?
"Ashley and I are together," Hud said.
Ashley watched his face as he spoke, stunned at the forthrightness of his words, the evenness of his voice.
"I fucked up in how I handled it. I lied to you, and I went behind your back, and I am sorry. But I love her."
Hud caught Ashley's eye for a brief second.
"And she loves me."
"Are you kidding me?"
Jay screamed, losing control of his voice as he continued to speak, its volume rising higher and higher with every second.
"That's your defense?"
Hud stepped closer to his brother and had a moment of sharp clarity. He would see this thing through. He would face every moment of it. And he would come out the other side with a brother and a wife and a child.
"I'm an asshole," Hud said. "I admit it."
"That doesn't even begin to—"
"No, it doesn't. You're right. But I need you to understand something. I'm not going to stop seeing her," Hud said. and I'm not going to let you stop speaking to me.
A crowd had started to form, and Jay was conscious of it, of the fact that every single person who became privy to this conversation was aware of his humiliation.
So tell me what you need from me in order to put this behind us.
What I need from you? Jay said. What I need from you is to stop sleeping with my ex-girlfriend!
No, Hud said, shaking his head. My answer is no.
When Jay lunged for Hud, it was not graceful. It was sloppy and scrappy and ugly, but it was effective. Before Hud even realized that his brother was aiming for him, his back was slammed down onto the lawn. Jay swung with reckless abandon, but Hud did not fight back. Hud's upper arm strength alone could have crushed his brother's windpipe, shattered a rib. The lone joy of being the stocky one was that you were the stronger one. Jay on top of Hud, punching and elbowing and grabbing for whatever limbs he could, was like a whippet on a pit bull. But Hud would not further shame his brother. Jay and Hud had borne witness to the full scope of each other's lives. They had lived in the same rooms, wished on the same stars, breathed the same air, been taught and reared by the same mother and teachers, been abandoned by the same father. They had traveled the same beaches, trespassed in the same oceans, surfed the same waves, stood on the same boards, made love to the same woman. But they were not the same men. They were not haunted by the same demons. They were fighting for different things. Ashley screamed as Jay's fist made a crack against Hud's nose.